Okay, we've got a bunch of things going on today, folks, you'll see from the programme. I'm going to say a few words. A disability history historian, Ian Hutchison, is going to come and say a few words about why we do disability history. Alex, our colleague from Swansea, will lead a rendering of a section from The Darkness by Joe Quarry. You'll already have heard Travelling Folk, so there'll be a bit of music here and there through the day. This afternoon, Ewan McVicar will talk about the local schools project. Rab Wilson will do a bit of poetry. And we end with a little discussion panel that Nicky Wilson is kindly chairing for us. I want to say a few words just now, folks, about the Disability History Project. This project is a 5-year project run from the University of Swansea and with 3 other partners in Aberystwyth, Northumbria University and the University of Strathclyde. And for my sins, I'm Arthur McIver. I'm running the Scottish end with my colleague Angela Turner. Angela, of course, does all the real work. I do very little. It's led by Anne Borsay and David Turner, and we have a team of 12 researchers working through this 5-year period. I could thank at this point all the people who've helped today. I really, really appreciate everybody's help. The museum, Ellie especially, for the venue. Ewan for his work with the schools. Alex for coming up from Swansea. Is it up or down? Up from Swansea. Representatives from the National Mining Museum. The NUM, Rowan from the Mine Museum, Siswu, Moret, Disability History Scotland, Ian and his colleagues, and other supporters. So many thanks, folks. Without your help, we would not be able to put this event on. So what's the project all about? Well, the key aim, really, is to explore the history of disability in coalfields. We're particularly interested in the lived experience of disability, but also in how different groups, like the union, like CISWA, like medics, have contributed to the history of disability in this place. We're particularly keen to explore the impact of industrialisation. The project runs from 1780 through to nationalisation. So we're particularly interested in the impact of the Industrial Revolution, industrialisation, upon miners' bodies and upon disability over this quite long period. Research included looking at things like poor law records, hospital records, trade union-friendly societies, government reports and inquiries, workmen's comp papers. Angela's just been working up some stuff on rehab, looking at the Uddingston Rehab Centre, amongst others. Probably familiar with many of you here. And the outcomes from all this research, with luck and fingers crossed, will be 2 books, a bunch of articles. Alex will produce a PhD thesis. We'll have an interactive project website. And we're organising a number of public engagement events here in Scotland, also in Wales. And in the northeast of England. The only for me to say this with this kind of audience, but historically, of course, the majority of coal mining disabilities and disabilities in coal mining communities have been caused by work. Coal mines were, of course, notoriously dangerous, very unhealthy places in which to work. Before nationalisation, safety standards were particularly poor. Pit disasters common. And miners suffer from a whole range of occupational diseases. We tend to think of the issues here in relation to disasters, the big disasters. Much more important, I think, is that steady drip of death and disability caused by roof falls and caused by these long-term chronic insidious diseases. Particularly important for miners were respiratory diseases. Bronchitis, emphysema, COPD, silicosis. Pneumoconiosis. But coal mining communities were blighted by a whole number of other things, arthritis and rheumatism, beat hand, beat knee, the chronic eye disease, nystagmus, a wide range of physical injuries, and also stress and stress and trauma. Hopefully some of these issues will emerge and can be discussed in the panel later this afternoon. In the 1920s, according to the Commission on the Coal Industry, coal miners had roughly a 1 in 3 chance of contracting one of these disabling diseases. On average, we've had 7 accidents in the course of a 40-year working life. And those figures, I think, give you a sense of just how dangerous and hazardous and unhealthy the job was. Just the kind of impact the job had upon the body, upon miners' bodies. The Royal Commission on Safety in 1935 produced these figures. In the 30s, 80% of all workers in the UK who were drawing workman's compensation for injuries and diseases and classified as long-term disabled, 80% were in the coal mining sector. This is what Tom Hamlin said in his book Yesterday Will Return in 1946 in relation to the impact of disability. The basic fear underlies the hopes of all men at the bottom rung of the sweated industry of the world. The fear of being physically unable in the only work you know, of slipping with those you love, slipping with you, to be trampled on in the sweated stampede that is life. I think a nice evocation there of just how precarious people's existences could be before the NHS, before the welfare state, if workers became disabled in any shape or form. Just a decade or so ago, the legislation for COPD, bronchitis and emphysema, which was achieved after a long 40-year struggle by the union, going back to the 1950s. As a result of this legislation, almost 500,000 individual claims were put in. It gives you a sense, I think, of the legacy, the long historical legacy of disability in relation to dust in the pits. And this afternoon in the panel, we'll hear from a miner who has silicosis, 20% silicosis, David McWilliam. A couple of pictures just to break up my rabbiting on, maybe get a sense here of the extent of dust. An example here of coal workers' pneumoconiosis, lungs infiltrated with coal dust. And on the right-hand side, a cartoon relating to what was the scourge of miners back in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s, silicosis, particularly, I think, associated with inhaling the rock fibres cutting through rock and dust cutting through rock in the pits. I just want to end with a couple of fragments of oral testimony. And one of the sources that Angela's been looking for, one of the sources we commonly use in the Scottish Oral History Centre at the University of Strathclyde, are miners' workers' own testimonies. There are 3 little extracts, and all of these, in one way or another, refer to the way in which, in the past, mining communities looked after disabled miners. Is George Bolton. If you're talking about dust, for example, obviously it affected, we're all affected. You became less fit, handicapped by dust. But for as long as possible, you covered up. And David Crothers, you see, we didn't bother. Sorry, I can't do the Scottish accent, guys. I'm from Coventry, so I'm not going to attempt it. Oh, that's terrible. You see, we didn't bother about any illness. You're on about different illnesses, such as TB, tuberculosis, things like that. Well, that was never discussed in the pit. You carried men as they got older. And Harry Steele, when you got older in the pit, the younger men kind of looked after the older ones. What point do you want to make about this, guys, is that this changes. Nikki was referring to this at our disability witness seminar a few weeks ago at the university. This does change. think as the closures deepened through the 60s, 70s, 80s, this process of looking after disabled miners disappeared. And this bit of testimony from David Guy, and so it's quite small, folks, and difficult to see, in an interview with our late colleague Neil Rafee, about 10 years ago, refers to this. This is what David Guy said. As long as they're able to work, or to get work in some shape or form, the management were pretty sympathetic to people in poor health, especially if it was caused by the work at the pit. And there was a tendency for the union and the management to work together to try and fix them up in jobs which they could cope with. And he continues, once the pit closed, that type of sympathetic approach wasn't there any longer by employers outside the industry. And he continues, but finishes, the reality is there isn't any sympathy for you if you've got a form of disablement. Employers want to take on people who they're going to be able to exploit to the maximum, so they don't want anyone who's got a bad chest or who have spinal injuries or neck injuries or arthritis. There is a reluctance of employers to employ people in that category. So I hope you really enjoyed today, guys. Amongst some of the issues we hope to address and touch on, and issues that are represented in the panels and the stalls, are the lived experience of disability, the intervention of medicine and rehabilitation, the role of state intervention, through nationalisation, through the Mines Acts, and things like the Workmen's Compensation legislation. We're interested in the intervention of groups like CISWA, the Coal Industry Social Welfare Organisation, and Marette's here representing CISWA. We're interested in campaign and advocacy. Now, what about the role of the union? What do the NUM do in relation to disability? I think the evidence strongly supports the argument that the NUM are one of the most active unions in disability politics, both in terms of prevention and compensation. Again, that might be something we knock about and talk about, not least in the discussion panel this afternoon. Now, we'll just add, folks, if you are miners or ex-miners, if you'd like to share your experiences with us, we'd love to take your contact details, perhaps arrange an interview at a later date. So I'd really encourage you guys, if you could, to share your memories with us and leave us with your contact details. Okay, now to introduce my colleague Ian. How are we doing for time? Ian teaches at the University of Glasgow. Ian is a real disability historian. He's written this beautiful book, A History of Disability in 19th Century Scotland. And Ian's going to address us for about maybe 15 minutes or so on why do disability history. Thanks so much. Ian?
Switch over onto the front.
Lost.
That's good. Do you want me to do that for you? Shall I do that for you?
Well, on the programme it says, why do we do disability history? And I'm not really going to say a lot about that. I'm actually going to look at...
Which one are you?
Start from there. I'm actually going to look at a couple of case studies and but start off with a little bit of personal connections which this event prompted me to look at. But why do we do disability history? I would argue it's because disability is actually mainstream. It's not a minority thing. It's about people, it's about families, it's about life, it's about communities. And unless we're fortunate or unfortunate enough to go out with a big bang when the time comes, we will all experience disability at some point in our lives. As I say, today's event got me to thinking about my own family background. So I'd like to introduce you to my great-grandmother, born in 1854, and she died in 1907. And she was married to James Sanderson. James Sanderson was a miner in a pit at Nakerty, which is on the outskirts of Addington, an area we call Up the Hill, it's up here. It doesn't exist anymore, it's totally disappeared. And he was a coal miner there. I don't have a photograph of him, but we do know that he had bright golden hair. And we know that because my grandmother wore a mourning brooch of him with a lock of his hair in it, which my brother now has. James Sanderson was a roadsman, and he died as the result of a roof collapse in Bredishole No. 3 Colliery at Nakerty. He was brought to the surface with spine injuries, and he was carried to his house in the miners' row in Nakerty village, and he died 14 hours after the accident. Had he survived, he would have been severely disabled. His death had implications, though, for the whole family. A 17-year-old son, who also worked underground, survived him, along with four daughters who were aged between 2 and 12. So the only waste now coming into the house was from the 17-year-old. Elizabeth Sanderson had to seek poor relief after James' death, and she eked out a living by undertaking laundry and as an untrained midwife. She's recorded in the census as being a midwife in 1901, which I find quite interesting because it was a self-taught thing. This was not a woman who had been trained. Indeed, on her marriage certificate, she wasn't able to sign her own name. She certainly in her younger years was not literate. The miners' rows at Nakerty were described in a Royal Commission investigation as being houses of the worst possible type. Each dwelling was a room and kitchen, or sometimes two rooms and a kitchen, but this second type was frequently subdivided between two families. Kitchen floors were either brick or stone. The houses were constantly damp. Families shared water closets or dry closets, ash pits and middens. Owned by the colliers, it's immediately apparent that these rows were not healthy places in which to live. The eldest daughter died 6 years later. She died from tuberculosis. Elizabeth Sanderson herself died from bronchial pneumonia at the age of 53. I think she would consider the older than her 53 years. I move on to the other side of my family. This is my grandfather, John Hutchison. He was born in the mining village of Glenbuck, famous for it as the birthplace of Bill Shankly. I was 3 years old when he died, and I have a fleeting memory of him sitting by the fireside in a top floor tenement house in Uddingston. Often he wore his bonnet and he had a selection of pipes and a rack on the wall beside him. The story is that my granny, Elizabeth Hutchison, came from the Sanderson side, had been down to the Bank Green to hang out the washing. Discovered when she was hanging out the washing, she'd left something upstairs, and she called up at the upstairs window. It was about September, the weather was still good. Called up at the open window for him to throw down the missing items of laundry. He didn't respond. So very disgruntled, she climbed back up the stairs and found him sitting in his fireside chair, dead. He died. As far as we can tell, he died of coronary thrombosis, but had long suffered from miner's lung. So it seems that my great-grandfather was cheated from being disabled by the sudden accidental death of the roof collapse, whereas my grandfather on the other side may have been disabled by miner's lung in his later years, although it was probably never highlighted as such at that time. When my own father left school at the age of 14, he initially worked at the pit head, but my grandfather was apparently adamant that no son of his was going underground. With the advance of medical science through the 18th and 19th centuries, disablement in its various forms became viewed as something broken in the body, in the mind, something to be fixed by surgeons and psychiatrists. This is the medical model of disability. By the late 20th century, it was increasingly argued by many disabled people and their supporters that they didn't necessarily need to be fixed. What caused disability was not an impairment, but society's attitudes towards them and their circumstances. Science has a role in contributing to the quality of life, but seeing all people as people is the challenge of the 21st century. Society needs to be accommodated in all its diversity, and this includes understanding and knowledge as much as it includes ramps and designated parking places. I'd like to give two stories of disability resulting from mining accidents, if I've got time. One is set in Ayrshire, and the other account comes from the Shetland Isles. So first of all, I'd like to tell you about James Baird. Born 1861, he lived till 1933. This probably typifies the type of incident that my grandfather had in mind when he declared that none of his lads were going down the pits. James Baird, the son of an Ayrshire miner, left school at 12 and began work underground as a drawboy, opening and closing ventilation doors and drawing the hutches through. When he was 13, a hutch ran over his foot, requiring its amputation above the ankle. He continued to work in coal mining for some time on the surface, separating coal from slag and later as a colliery check weighman, and he was also a union representative. In 1882, now aged 21, James Baird joined the Salvation Army. When that organisation established a life assurance society, Baird became one of its agents. It was a job that required a lot of walking, climbing of stairs, and it gave him a new career and a long one. His grandson, James Anderson, who grew up in Baird's home, recalled him as a relatively old man by the time he knew him. Anderson believed that Baird, quote, attained a certain status in the community despite his handicap, or perhaps because of it. Baird was a proud man, an independent character, and quite probably was strong-willed and a little bit stubborn. James Anderson recalled an incident that demonstrates this. He says, "My grandfather had an artificial foot he'd made himself. He carved a solid piece of timber into the shape of a foot. To that was riveted four upright metal supports which formed a cradle for a sheaf of leather to go round the inside. And inside that, his leg went, wrapped in various cloths, clothing parts. When we were going on holiday, we would have to collect subscriptions," this is for the insurance, "in advance, so I was called in to help him. On one occasion, an accident happened. A rivet came adrift on this artificial leg, and he was left limping along. So he had to have this immediate repair, but it was not taken to a repairer. He limped down the hill, leaning on my shoulder, down to Titchfield Street." This is in Galston, in Ayrshire. "And he went to Young's Garage. He took off his injured leg, this damaged foot of his, and I was told to operate the handle or the bellows, and we got the furnace to a red-hot heat. He stuck this piece of metal in the flame until it was red-hot, stuck it on, got a rivet and hammered it in. And when all was done, he plunged it into the water and it went shh, 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 and he cooled the thing down until he was able to put his leg back in it. And we carried on as if nothing had happened, collecting his agency. That's the kind of man he was." It was not until the late 1920s that James Baird had his first professionally made leg fitted. This is in the aftermath of World War I, when different perspectives, if you like, on artificial limbs perhaps developed, and small businesses making them set up for World War I disabled. So James Anderson, he went with his grandfather into Glasgow for the fitting. And he describes it. He says, he was measured and an artificial limb was fitted. This other one he'd made himself was very heavy, and for years he climbed up and down tenement stairs in Glasgow, Falkirk, wherever he was appointed, dragging this great leg. He didn't complain, he carried on. His new limb must have been a tremendous relief. It was made of very light aluminium metal. Where his cast iron rods had been was now light aluminium. It was solid and it was thinly made, and he didn't have to wrap it up with so many rags to fill up the space for his stump. And say, I think disabled soldiers were a big part of the growing up, if you like, the expansion of an artificial limb industry in the 1920s. But until that point, say, Baird had totally relied on self-help. That was his remedy. So the question really is, was Baird disabled? Or more importantly, did he consider himself to be disabled? The other example concerns a man by the name of Malcolm Duncan. He was born about 1841. He was affected by an explosion. He was 36 years of age when this happened. And I've chosen this one really to show that mining was not just across Scotland's central belt, and it was not just in the pursuit of coal. This incident occurred in Shetland in 1878, where the mine was primarily looking for copper. In describing what happened and his circumstances, he said, "I've been employed at the Sand Lodge mines, which are carried on by the Sumbara Mining Company, for about 4 years. I wrought as a labourer above for 3 years, and during the last year I wrought below." This mine, it sits roughly about halfway between Lerwick and the very southernmost tip of the Shetland mainland, Sumbara, where the airport is. It was a small mine, and say Malcolm Duncan worked there as a general labourer. He continues, "During the year I wrought below, there were always above a dozen of miners who were employed below. Sometimes during that time there were about 16 or 17 men employed below and about 12 above." That gives you an idea of the size. "After I went below, I wrought on wages and was employed in shoveling ore and at times at heaving up ore from the inclining shaft to the foot of the main shaft from where it was taken up by steam. I never saw any rules published at the works, and none were ever read to me, no health and safety. John Murray, Alexander Murray, Francis McPherson, Nicol Lawrenson and I entered into a contract in the spring of last year to cut out at £7.10 a fathom length, the driver of which was 5 feet by 6. We did not have a written contract as far as I'm aware." He further describes the work. He says, "We wrought by turns, 2 at a time, and then a stretch of 8 hours at a time. Before 2 left, they were always relieved by another 2. We paid for the powder and the other requirements and for the sharpening of tools. The tools used in boring were pumpers or drills made of steel and hammers. After the powder had been put in, we put in wadding and rammed it with an iron, clamping rod or stemmer. We did not use any pricker when a charge missed fire. We generally bored it out or unrammed it. This did not occur often." And the particular incident, he says, "On 4 September last, John Murray and I went below at 2 o'clock and after boring 3 holes, we stemmed 2 and set fire to them. One of these charges missed fire and after waiting about an hour, we went to it and commenced to unram it with the drill. The hole at first was 20 inches depth of powder in it. When we had bored about 9 inches, it went off and severely injured my hands." As I was holding the drill at the time and Murray the hammer. The explosion also seared Murray's hands and arms, and the hammer drove out three of his teeth. Doctors Burgess of Scalloway and McMillan of Dunross Ness were called. They found it necessary, from the extent of the injury received by me, to amputate both my hands. Duncan's account was corroborated by three fellow workers. One man added that their rescue had been delayed by a quarter of an hour because the cage had been left unattended where the engineer had gone for his supper. Duncan had no further prospects of employment as a miner following the loss of both of his hands. Proof of negligence on the part of the company would have been of little consolation to him. Artificial arms were made for him by a local blacksmith, and he worked delivering telegrams on foot. The blacksmith fashioned a clip on one of his artificial arms to hold the telegram. You can't see that very well here. You can see the other one with a hook. I say the other arm had a hook, and he was known because of this. He was known as Hooky Mikey. When this photograph was taken, he was in his late 60s. As with Baird, and at a time before any public welfare other than the poor law, would Duncan have described himself as disabled? Life had to go on. The poor law was for those who could not work and had no relatives to support them. So it was to stave off destitution and little more. This is, say, a period before even the most basic of liberal welfare reforms came in the 1900s. James Baird and Malcolm Duncan were both strong-willed and independent characters, determined to live with their disabilities on their own terms. Equally, it might be argued that they had little choice than to make the best of difficult situations. However, it can be agreed, I think, that these cases highlight just a couple of the dangers faced by minors, and they illustrate that their disabilities were life-changing. Had my great-grandfather survived, paralysed through a broken back, his post-accident experience would have been quite different from those of Baird and Duncan. Thank you very much. If there's time and anyone wants to ask any questions, I'll do my best.
Thanks very much, Ian. Any questions or comments for Ian?
I take a very broad interpretation of disability. I look on temporary impairment as well as permanent impairment, and I certainly look on mental impairment as part of it. Because the thing is too that mental impairment, mental troubles, and physical troubles often come together anyway. You know, if someone has, we just take some of these examples here. I think these were strong, resilient men. But someone who has limbs blown off, they've got a serious physical impairment, but it's going to affect them psychologically as well.